Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on June 5th, 2005, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And, of course, this is WILL-AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's a pleasure to be here with you, the live show. We have a terrific show for you today, one I think you're going to enjoy. It's our last live show for a few weeks, so be sure to get your calls in. Our guest today, noted filmmaker, actor, director, Tim Robbins, joining us live on the air. So please stay tuned for today's Media Matters. First, though, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The smoke is clearing from a showdown in Texas that pit phone companies against cable TV giants and put local control over next-generation networks at risk. SBC and Verizon led a lobbying charge to ram through legislation that would have allowed phone companies to negotiate statewide franchise agreements to offer TV service over their networks. Franchise agreements are essentially leasing contracts which specify how much companies must pay to run cables and wires along public rights of way. Cable companies negotiate franchise agreements on a community-by-community basis. The SBC-Verizon proposal would have dramatically simplified the negotiation process for the phone companies by putting it at the state level, but at the expense of local governments, which would have lost the right to charge for access to their own rights of way. Opposition from cities, towns, and concerned citizens set the Texas House and Senate at odds over details in the bill, and the legislative session came to a close over the Memorial Day weekend without an agreement. This battle was doubly significant because it took place in Texas, SBC's home state, where it employs one lobbyist for every two lawmakers in Austin. Now some of that lobbying might is focused on Washington, D.C., where Congressman Pete Sessions, a Republican from Texas, just introduced a bill in the House of Representatives that would prohibit local governments from building out their own broadband networks and running them like any other utility. For the record, Pete Sessions spent 16 years working for SBC, first as a manager, then executive, before embarking on his political career. And after a decade plus in Congress, SBC ranks as the congressman's number two corporate donor in terms of dollars.
Other congressional activity expected this summer involves broadcast television's transition from analog to digital. About 700 local TV stations now broadcast in digital, and lawmakers are expected to take up legislation that would mandate a hard deadline for turning off the old analog signals. Large chunks of spectrum freed up by the transition could then be auctioned for other uses, netting billions of dollars for the U.S. Treasury. A preliminary proposal in the House would turn off analog TV at the end of 2008. But there's lots of disagreement over exactly how to make the switch, including whether the government should subsidize the transition for those who can't afford new DTV-compatible sets, and how much of the reclaimed spectrum will be set aside for public safety and other non-commercial uses.
One person with a unique perspective about the recent controversies in the world of public broadcasting is Jack Mitchell. He was National Public Radio's first employee, co-created the program All Things Considered, and spent three terms as chair of NPR's board of directors in the mid to late 1980s. He's now a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and just published a book on NPR's history. Mitchell says there's not a lot of influence the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and its chairman, Kenneth Tomlinson, can exert on public radio directly, given that NPR is funded primarily through its affiliate stations. However, he's very displeased that the chair of CPB is also running the government's international media initiatives like the Voice of America.
To have the same person essentially overseeing our propaganda operations abroad and then also be in charge of public broadcasting internally, I think is outrageous and makes the assumption that public broadcasting in this country is supposed to be the same as our overseas operations. And there's a difference. There's a big difference.
Back in Washington, new bills in Congress would establish a special fund for public broadcasting, primarily to help public radio and TV stations make the conversion from analog to digital. While this new money source would be separate from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, it's not yet clear just how it would be managed.
Sometimes truth calls from unexpected places. At a mostly scripted forum on Social Security held May 24th in New York, President George W. Bush suffered a truthful moment as he reiterated a prime talking point of his plan to partially privatize the Social Security system.
If you've retired, you don't have anything to worry about. It's the third time I've said that. I'll probably say it three more times. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to kind of catapult the propaganda.
Surprisingly, the unedited video and transcript of this forum is still available through the White House website.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 on a very hot summery day in Urbana, Illinois. Thank you all for joining in today. We've got a terrific show for you. Joining us later in the program, in just a few minutes, we trust, will be Tim Robbins. We'll be talking to Tim. He's out in Los Angeles today. We're going to be talking to Tim about a number of issues, not the least of which is the DVD of his stage play, which has just been released, called Embedded Live. But before we get Tim on the line, and I think Tim's about ready to join us, actually, so let's go right to Tim now. Tim, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I know how busy your schedule is, so it's especially on a Sunday, so it's an honor to have you here. I was just starting to introduce you, thinking we were going to have another minute or two before we got you. We were talking about Embedded Live. I've had a chance to see this recently, the DVD, and it's now being released through Netflix. Can you talk a little bit about it? Because I've got a feeling a lot of our listeners are not yet familiar with it.
Well, Embedded Live is a filmed version of a play I did at the Public Theater last year. I filmed the last four performances of it with nine cameras and a live audience, and it was. Then I did 3 days of extra shooting with close-ups and filmic elements. The play is a satire about the lead up and the actuality and the consequence of the Iraq War. It was written in the May June of 2003. It was written out of a frustration and anger, I suppose. And what was really remarkable about it for myself and for the members of the Actors Gang was that from the first moment that we performed this play, we realized that there was something extraordinary happening with the audience, and it was a kind of an angry laughter, a laughter that was rooted in their own frustrations. Not a ha-ha guffawing kind of, oh, let's just relax and be in the theater. It was kind of a more active, kind of aggressive involvement with the play. And as we progressed with the play in Los Angeles, where it started, and then consequently in New York and then London and in a national tour, we found that to be the case everywhere. The best audiences were ones that were so involved in the play, but also it wasn't just about acceptance. It was about a kind of a tension that was in the theater that was really exciting, and so I think we've captured that with this film.
Yeah, one of the things that was striking to me about the film was how smart it is. I mean, you go into Leo Strauss and the neoconservatives. Clearly, this is an area you've been thinking about or reading about, because you couldn't have just come up with this over a couple of weeks in May and June of 2003.
Well, I had been reading. I had been doing research before the play, pulling articles, reading various websites. I got most of my information. Well, through the prism of the major networks here and the New York Times, I was also reading The Guardian and The Independent in the UK to see how they were reporting events. And it was, you know, typical and remarkable still that, that such a different version of reality exists on those two planes. England still does have a real functioning press. I'm sure that they're in the throes of some challenge to that, but at least still now there is a free press. Even the Times of London, which is a Murdoch paper, was engaged in a fair debate before the war between both sides, not misrepresenting or marginalizing the opposition, but really allowing them their space and time in the editorial pages to make their case. You didn't have that here. You just simply didn't have it. We had a cheerleading section. And one of the things that struck me, because I was trying to figure out how do these people make these decisions? How do you rationalize lying to a country to put its young men and women at risk? What are the conversations in the back room? And that's when I became interested in Leo Strauss. In writing the satire of the Office of Special Plans, a group, by the way, that was never even mentioned in the New York Times. In fact, when the play opened in New York in 2004, the New York Times critics said that I made up this place called the Office of Special Plans. And then you Google search New York Times and Office of Special Plans, you realize that the paper had only mentioned it twice in the past 2 years. So I became curious about what this philosophy was. In fact, a few leading neoconservatives were students of his, or acolytes of his, or students of his. And turns out there's a rationalization within this philosophy. Whether it was actually Leo Strauss or a bastardization of Leo Strauss is up to better minds than mine to figure out. But essentially, what they were saying was that it is okay to lie. The greater lie for the greater good. The big lie. The idea that you can rationalize these kinds of decisions in your own back room, in your own boardroom, that the masses aren't really smart enough to understand. So we have to make these decisions. It's our burden. It's our responsibility. We, the philosopher kings, we, the enlightened, we, the educated, that simply understand better than the masses what is necessary for their survival. And if that means lying to them, then we must do it. And we must do it because it's truly a benevolent thing we are doing. And you start to think about that, and then you start to, you know, kind of get how this kind of rationalization can happen. It's done out of benevolence, and that's the crazy thing about it. They really think they're doing that they're highly enlightened people that are making decisions for the rest of us.
We're talking to Tim Robbins today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so we do take phone calls. The number, of course, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And the key part of the play, or of the DVD now, it's really more than a play. Play doesn't do justice to what one sees on the DVD with all the editing. But a key part of Embedded Live is a recurring sort of group of the neocons meeting wearing masks, and you're one of the several, there are probably, what, seven or eight of them?
There's six.
Six. Oh, well, you take up so much room, Tim. That's it. And, I mean, it's almost like strange Lovian humor that you employ, the satire. But it's really very entertaining and very funny, but also very chilling. Because it could be said at points, although I think you reduce it to the absurd at points. But it's sort of the ongoing dialogue that intersperses the entire play. And what character do you play? I mean, I recognized Wolfowitz and Condi Rice and, Rumsfeld. Which character are you?
I play kind of an amalgam of, he's called Cove, and he's kind of an amalgam of Karl Rove and Lee Atwater and Rush Limbaugh. And
yeah, you've got Rush Limbaugh's old physique. That was what jumped out.
Yeah. I see all of the characters in those sections, you know, were kind of loosely based on who these people are, on what they've said, on the kind of actions they've taken. But really, they're more amalgams than specific people. And that's made readily apparent whenever you try to do any work in one of the masks that we use. The masks really determine who the characters are. In fact, we had a guy come in when we were workshopping the play and did a spot-on Rumsfeld imitation in the mask.
Mm-hmm.
And it just simply didn't work. You know, it was the wrong voice for the mask.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that we couldn't do imitations. It just simply won't hold water. And it's not what we're interested in doing either. We're not interested in doing parody. We're interested in finding the deeper truth in these characters, and you can find them through the masks. And in order to find that absurd level of humor, you have to really find the truth of the emotion behind their actions.
Well, it really does work. There's no doubt about it. And Embedded Live, if someone's interested in seeing the DVD, it is now available through Netflix, if I understand it. Is that basically the way to get it now?
Well, it's available for rental on Netflix if you're a member, or you can become a member by renting Embedded. But it's also available for sale at embeddedlive.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
We've got Tim Robbins as our guest today in Media Matters. We have a couple of phone callers waiting. Before I get to the phone calls, though, I do want to ask you a little bit about the Actors Gang, who are the performers on Embedded Live. And I was doing a little research for the show, and I gather that Actors Gang goes back a couple decades. I mean, this is not a group just recently thrown together.
No, we've been together since college, actually. We're 23 years old. We came out of UCLA. We were kind of renegade punk rockers in the theater department that wanted to do our own kind of theater and wanted to bring a kind of different energy onto stage than we were being taught at university. We wanted to be more like punk rockers than theater geeks. And we started with a wild production of a play called Ubu Wah. Have done, over 75 productions and won over 100 awards over the past 23 years. And we're over 50 members now. And it's a great organization. It's constantly growing. We take in interns every year, and we do educational programs with local districts in Los Angeles, and we do that for free. We don't charge for that. It's a lot of great volunteerism in the group, and a great spirit of unity. And it's a tremendous group. It's what's gotten me by the past 23 years, to a large degree, in this town, Los Angeles. Whenever I've been here, it's always an oasis for me, away from the kind of self-adulation that is that can happen in show business.
Okay, we're talking to Tim Robbins today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the new film, Embedded Live, which Tim Robbins wrote and directed and, I guess, produced of sorts.
I also did the catering.
And you did the catering, but you sell the tickets that night. It seemed like you did about everything.
It's a brand new animal for me. I've never completely been the person behind a film, and I'm now in a situation where I'm kind of distributing it by myself too, which is a new animal for me.
You know, we later in the show, I want to talk about Cradle Will Rock, your last film, which was a terrific movie, which I believe was distributed and helped produce by Touchstone, a Disney company. Is that right?
That's correct.
And did you approach any of the studios about Embedded Live to see if they'd be interested in distributing this?
I did. Yes. It's not material I think that people are comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, because 10 years ago that wouldn't have been okay. But it's okay now because we're living in an era of possibilities with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's providing alternate distribution systems. And so I'm quite content that I don't have to make any sacrifices in this material, and I can retain ownership of it and determine how it's distributed. That's something that is kind of a new paradigm. It's kind of starting in this small way and seeing what happens. And we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens in a couple months, and maybe it will find distribution that way. I don't know.
Well, let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Hi, I have a couple of things. One about the career, and this fact shows how long you've been on the media beat. I remember fondly Conflagration, which should have done what John Stewart's lampooning of the Crossfire phenomena did years later. I wish it would have deep sixed it sooner.
What he's talking about is a play called Mayhem: The Invasion, which I did in '92. And it was set on a game show called Conflagration, which is a debating show between historians. And they're debating the legacy of Columbus. We did it for the 500th year of Columbus anniversary. And it was. Thank you for remembering that.
Well, I didn't get it accurate, so I'm glad for the extra information. And it was a radio play, right?
That's right. We did it on the actual birthday of Columbus.
Huh. Well, I hope you do more in that medium, since it's low overhead and it hits me where I live. So, but I wanted to do something right out of the newspapers today. We have I was out of town, and so I saw the St. Louis Post-Dispatch's AP story on Bolton Force diplomat out. This is the story of the Brazilian chemical weapons expert who Bolton forced out because he was going to start some more inspections in Iraq and look for chemical weapons, and the U.S. didn't want that to happen because, it would have delayed the push to war. The curious thing that I find is that the Post-Dispatch's version of the AP story is different from our local hometown paper here. The Post-Dispatch, at the very end of the story, has the story of the Downing Street memo. And since you mentioned that you go to the British press a lot, and the fact that Blair is in town tomorrow, I think that we should definitely alert people to the fact that those questions need to be asked.
So the Downing Street memo reference was deleted out of your local paper.
Right.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. We're fond of the News Gazoo, but it was actually used by this CIA in the 50s as an experiment in opinion formation, and Professor McChesney knows more about that because it was done out of the ICR, where he's now changing the tone. Applauds, kudos, and greetings to your lovely wife, Susan.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, Tim, that leads to a great question,
it's very interesting that was brought. I was on, I guess, what is it called? Hardball the
mm-hmm.
other day.
Yeah, Chris Matthews.
And I mentioned the Downing Street memo. And he said, "What's that?" I think he clearly knew, but he wanted me to say. But it was interesting that if you look at who's reporting that and who's not, and it's a clear indication that there's something severely wrong with the media. But from that important story to something that's kind of an absurd version of that. This year I was given the Hasty Pudding Award at Harvard, which is a totally ridiculous, fun kind of event, where the future leaders of America dress up in drag and roast you and roast your career, and they give a man of the year and a woman of the year. And so I went up to Harvard and spent the day on campus and talked to a lot of students. It was a lovely day and, really nice environment, and people were sweet. And so we did the roast that evening, and at one point during the roast, there was these guys that came out dressed in huge high heels and in drag and these ridiculous wigs and the kind of Madonna conical bras, and They had protest signs, and they said, you know, with names of my movies on the Mission to Mars, and a couple of the movies that didn't do so well. And they're saying, no more bad movies, no more bad movies. And I thought it was very funny. I laughed, and the thing proceeded on, and it got to the end of the evening, and, you know, had some fun, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, next day, AP reports that student protesters interrupted my Man of the Year award. Student protesters at Harvard interrupted this, and without any mention of context or the fact that it was, you know, guys in bustiers, it went out across the country and then around the world, basically saying that I couldn't go to this innocuous event without being protested against by students. Which couldn't be farther from the truth, because I was walking around that campus all day, and more often than not, people were coming up and saying, thank you for saying stuff, thank you for being against this war, we don't have a voice. Always that kind of attention that I get. Yet the news coming, and AP especially, to send this message out across the country, again, in a long succession of messages being sent regarding free speech, regarding those that use free speech, the idea that there are ramifications for it, which only lead to intimidation and silence.
We're talking to Tim Robbins today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have a couple of phone lines open at 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Tim Robbins, of course, the actor, screenwriter, director, and producer, has a new film out, Embedded Live, available at embeddedlive.com. Is that right, Tim?
That's right.
Or through Netflix, if one is a member of Netflix. You're also going to be in War of the Worlds, which is coming out soon, too, right?
That's right.
And you've got some other work I noticed online. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Edgar County, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Tim, congratulations for keeping at it.
Oh, thanks.
And also, I think we should also give thanks to George Wolfe for allowing your play to be produced at Public Theater.
Yes, absolutely. He's a real courageous artist and a generous person.
Yeah, and fortunately we've changed horses now, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, hopefully Oscar will be as good for theater as George was.
Because I remember 35 years ago with Joe Papp and working with Pinero. So,
We did our first play at the Public was Joe Papp invited us to do in 88, I believe it was.
I was just before Joe passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, can we...
By the way, Ubawah was produced at the University of Illinois in 1959.
I hope they were repelled by it.
I thought we did a very good job.
No, but it's kind of the best. I think the best reaction is there's got to be some people in the audience that are a little hurt or offended by it.
Yes, well, but, you know, 59, we didn't know what we were doing. Let me ask you, you're a voice, and there are other voices, and as Bob knows, I'm, you know, a public relations person. Why haven't we gotten our act together to be as focused as is, if you want to say, the other side?
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I think it has to do with media outlets. I think there was an excellent article by Lewis Lapham in August Harper's last year. It kind of breaks down how the neoconservatives got such a consistent voice in the media. Essentially, they understood that a minority could never rule in a democracy without making the majority feel like a minority. And the way they've done that is to somehow convince these people, this majority, to vote against their best interests. And the way they've done that is through a consistent litany of voices that have been essentially lying. for years. Talk radio, everything that Limbaugh and all the other talking heads on the radio have been doing for the past 15 years is essentially marching orders from the Weekly Standard. You know, they actually get talking points. And they've been driving home this message for years. And if anyone has any doubt about the veracity of what their message has been, one only need look at the current situation right now. They have triumphed. They are in control. They're in power. They've got both houses. They've got the House of Representatives. They've got the Senate. They've got the executive branch, the presidency. They've got the judicial. And they've got most of the media. So why aren't they happy? And why aren't they getting done what they've been advocating to be done for all these years? Because they never wanted that, Joe Working Class, Joe Six-Pack. They never wanted it. They've been lying to you.
So where do you think we go here politically, Tim? What's your this is still a minority movement, despite having all the political power in your view. How does the majority fight back?
Well, I think that the first step is to turn off your television and
Not your radio.
Not your radio. There's still some some voices out there. And an encouraging sign, you know, the rise of Air America, I think, is really exciting. And shows like yours. There is a voice that is not silenced yet. There is the tremendous potential of the internet and the idea that you can get information that is unfiltered and doesn't have to go through editorial boards and corporate boards. That's how it starts, and that's how it grows. And who knows how long it'll take? But the good news is that, you know, this isn't. We haven't gotten so bad that they're censoring shows like this and the internet. We have to take that, and we have to spread information and spread the good word that there is the truth is available out there. It's just don't think you're going to get it handed to you on your lap or delivered to your doorstep.
We're talking to Tim Robbins today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Tim Robbins, actor, screenwriter, director, and producer, needs no introduction, I think, to our listening audience, has a new DVD out, Embedded Live, which is based on the play that the Actors Gang produced in Los Angeles and New York, and I guess London. And it's a terrific DVD. I've had the privilege of seeing it. It's available on Netflix or at embeddedlive.com. Tim, in a recent piece you wrote for the Huffington Post, you have a wonderful passage in here where you say, now is the time for American artists to tell the truth to power. Now is the time to testify, to stand up and be counted. For, you know, your friends in the entertainment industry and your colleagues, what are the barriers that face trying to tell truth to power and have a successful career as an actor or filmmaker or in the entertainment industry?
Well, I'm one that has never acknowledge that barrier is there. I think probably people believe that there are barriers. I think probably there are some people that that feel they can't speak their minds, their opinions, and still have a successful career. I don't think that's true. I think that's the intention of intimidation is to make people believe that. But it's like any bully. If you stand up to them, you know, they back down. And who knows whether my career would be any different if I had shut my mouth 15 years ago. I would probably posit that it would be different. I would be a lot less happy. I'd be a person that has marginalized himself into another person. In other words, I think there's more cost to the self to not express your opinion, to censor yourself, to be politically expedient, to let your actions be determined by your desire for more wealth or fame. That I feel is so compromising. That I feel is also, as far as what it is to be an American and to have freedom of speech, it doesn't work if you don't use it.
You know, a couple
it's a muscle that atrophies. And if you think you have freedom of speech but you never speak out, you might as well be living in a Soviet style country. If you don't use this right, then you're going to lose that right.
A couple of years ago, we had right after the invasion of Iraq, we had Mike Farrell and Robert Greenwald on together, and both of them were talking about this same issue, and I think gave answers very similar to yours. But I think what Farrell and Greenwald both said was they knew lots of people in the industry in Los Angeles who were frustrated by their ability to find work that allowed them to express what they really believed in. That you know, a lot of their friends were doing work they didn't really feel strong about, but they needed to do basically to make a living.
And there's nothing wrong with that, seriously. I mean, you know, I can't pass judgment on people for any work they take. It's just, you know, it's easy for me because I'm, you know, I'm comfortable. I'm not going to make a judgment on someone that does a commercial for a Hummer, you know. You know, whatever you have to do to pay the rent, you do. It's where you get to a certain level of your career, and you no longer have to make commercials. That if you're advocating something, then I might have a problem with it. If you're advocating something that is harmful, and you don't need the money, but I know a lot of actors that you know are just getting by. You know, it's a tough profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was the point that Farrell was trying to make.
Yeah, so I don't pass judgment on that. I do have a problem with people that come up to you at award shows that are famous actors and whisper under their breath, "Hey, thanks for speaking out against the war." I have a problem with that because it makes me sad that someone feels so intimidated that they have to whisper in America. You know?
Yeah, we're talking to Tim Robbins today in Media Matters. We've got a few callers patiently waiting. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Yes, so way back you talked about Leo Strauss, and I was wondering if you or Dr. McChesney or anybody else in the audience could talk about the neocons and their manipulation of religion or how this relates to Leo Strauss or does it, about ideology and theocracy and things of that nature, power.
Oops, I think I lost her there, but yeah, I think we got the gist of the question, Tim.
Well, feel free to do it yourself if you want to, Bob.
I think you've done more work on Leo Strauss based on what I saw of Embedded Live. You're probably better to answer this
than
I am.
I think what the contention is that at their heart, they're really not tremendously religious people, but they know that religion is a great means for control, and that it allows for a public to be unified against an evil, and I think we're seeing the result of that. Now, I don't know. It's very difficult to talk in generalities with people I don't know and haven't met personally.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that any of these specifically any of these neocons. Or in any particular way, I can't make a judgment like that. But what I can do with a satire is I can try explore the philosophy of this Leo Strauss and make a character that is in to some degree a follower or an acolyte of him. I don't know if Richard Pearl is particularly religious. I don't know. I'd have to really know that person to be able to say that. But part of the philosophy has to do with control and the ideas of what can pacify a populace.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to let you know that My old TV, conked out about 5 years ago, and I never bought another one, and I don't know why I would ever even bother to have one. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing how free it makes you.
Yeah, there are so many things to do in this world without brainwashing yourself in front of the tube. Second, I'm not sure how much hope I would really have for the long run as for what these neocon types can do, but I think in the short run, you know, we've had it so easy for so many decades now that I think there's a learning curve where people have gotten complacent and they just assume government's going to take care of them, they assume corporations are going to take care of them, and of course that's exactly when the neocon types can take advantage of that. And so maybe, hopefully, at least, in the short run, we can, have some kind of a learning curve where people do figure out, oh, wait a second, it doesn't work that way, and maybe we can stave off this final whatever it is they've got planned for the rest of us, and maybe it won't happen right away.
Well, thank you very much for calling, Connor. Tim, one thing I wanted to follow up on, when I saw Embedded Live, what really happened to me was it made me think back to Cradle of Rock, your film from 5 or 6 years ago, which was about sort of progressive theater in the 1930s and the concern with the labor movement then and social justice, and how actors and actresses worked to really try to use the theater in a progressive manner. And so I think the comparison was, just jumped out at me. It was a terrific film, but it didn't seem to get the traction I would have thought it would have gotten. I mean, in Madison, where I lived at the time, it showed in one theater and was packed almost every night for 2 or 3 weeks. But it had a quiet run nonetheless, and that was in Madison.
Yeah. It was a level – there's a certain level of frustration with that for me. I really am very proud of that movie, and it was a real tough one to pull off. I mean, 4 or 5 stories going on at the same time, and kind of a picaresque of 30s America. And so thank you for saying that. Basically, what happened was, the bottom line is, a gentleman named Joe Roth was running Disney at the time, and in much in the manner of old Hollywood, I walked into that office. He had read the script. He asked me what my budget was and said, "Go ahead, kid," And that doesn't happen very often. And it was his generosity and his support that made that film happen. Especially, ironically, at Disney. And unfortunately, Joe left the studio right before it came out. So it wasn't really supported on its release, and in fact, when it got distributed out into the country, it only went into, I believe, 200 theaters, and wasn't particularly advertised very well, or wasn't much in local papers announcing its arrival. But where it did play, it did well, and so it's something that I think. I'm not sure whether it has to do with the content of it or whether people just didn't get it at the studio or didn't feel they could sell it. But what I do find really curious is that there's big sections of the world, like Australia and Germany and, big markets overseas where it hasn't even been released on DVD. And that's for me, a big question, something that I have people looking into, but I think it's a movie that will stand the test of time, and maybe it'll be rediscovered by the next generation of film critics. We'll see.
Well, it's absolutely timeless, that's for sure. There's nothing that it's as current today as it was 6 years ago. And just for sake of listeners, I'd urge people to go online and Google Cradle of Rock to learn about the film, because it is really an extraordinary story. Tim Robbins, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have a couple of phone lines open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Before we go to the phone lines, though, I just got a note handed to me by my producer. There is a severe thunderstorm warning for Ford County until 2:30 today. So if you're out there in Ford County, get inside and lock up those windows. Okay, let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Jim Robbins.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a couple of comments, and then I'll listen to you respond. The first one concerns the DVD, Angels in America, which I saw recently. And I was listening to you talk about your roles in Embedded, and it reminded me of Pacino's portrayal of Roy Cohn in that movie. And I thought that was an excellent portrait of the compassionate conservatives who are now running our country. My second comment is about Mystic River. I think you brought this up a little bit in in your commentary on the DVD, but when I saw the movie, there was a scene of the parade at the end. There was a shot of the American flag, and it just struck me that how appropriate that was in terms of the violence that was portrayed in the movie in terms of how we go about solving our problems. And when I saw that flag in the parade scene, it also reminded me of something that your wife had said when we were, when Bush was trying to drum up support for our march to invasion. And she had said that if we were, in fact, to invade Iraq, we would be teaching a horrible lesson to our children. And that's something that I just thought was so powerful at the time. So I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
You know, Tim, before you answer, I've been a negligent host. I should have mentioned that you won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Mystic River in 2003. It's probably, for most of our listeners, except for maybe Shawshank Redemption, your best-known role.
Oh, thanks. That movie, I think, does speak about violence, and I'm not sure if it's necessarily about America as much as it is about that terrible cycle of violence that happens, from abuse to self-abuse to retributive abuse. That's a worldwide problem. That's something that propels war after war. One generation's not being able to forget the previous generation's abuses against their cousin, their uncle, their father, their grandmother. That's what's kept violence going on for so many years, is our inability to stop the cycle. And so what Susan said is indeed true. Here we are sending the lesson. And boy, what a lesson it's becoming as more and more truth comes out, that it's okay to lie to justify an invasion of a country and to put our young men and women at risk on the basis of a lie. That's something that is unfortunately kind of subversive to the better principles of democracy. And if you have a public that is now cynically understanding this, this does not bode well for us as a country that should be honoring honesty and truth and justice. We've sent a terrible message, I think the only way around it, I'm not the first to say this, but I think the only way to a peace of mind is the only way to deal with this is to, for someone to take responsibility. And ultimately, I think the only thing that can rectify this situation is someone losing their job.
I suspect you have some good ideas for who that person could be.
Well, I think we could start at the top.
Yeah, I figured you'd head there.
And I don't think impeachment is beyond question here. he willfully misled the American public, and thousands upon thousands of people are dead because of it.
And Representative John Conyers, who I think we mentioned earlier because he's leading the campaign right now to demand that the Bush administration explain the Downing Street memo, has in fact discussed in this vein the issue of impeachment if there's not a satisfactory answer by the Bush administration to the contents of the Downing Street memo. Tim, we've got a couple of callers I want to get to before we leave, but a couple of questions have been emailed in from people who've asked us to relay them to you. First of all, do you have any projects of note in the next year or two you'll be working on people should keep an eye on?
I've done a film called The Secret Life of Words, which I'm real proud of. It should be coming out sometime at the end of the year or early next year.
Is that with Sarah Polley?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a doing a play in L.A. probably in January or February next year.
Do you know what the play is yet, or is it?
I'm doing the stage adaptation of 1984.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. And what media do you regularly use and read or consume to sort of stay on top of the world and sort of give you a perspective that goes outside the boundaries of the commercial news media?
Well, I've been a supporter and board member of Fairness in Accuracy and Reporting for a long time now. I think they're a valuable source. I read the New York Times just to see what the word of the day is.
Mm-hmm.
But I get my I get more truth and honesty out of The Nation, The Progressive, various websites. Alternet.
And you mentioned some of the European media, the Independent and the Guardian in
Independent
England.
Independent and the Guardian, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a couple of callers.
Counterpunch.
Counterpunch, yes. We've got and our listeners will recognize, I think the editors of all those publications have been guests on this program in the last 6 months. We've got a couple of callers patiently waiting. Let's go back to the phone lines. Champagne, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Hi.
Hello.
I just have a quick question. If things continue in the direction that they're going right now with the neocons gaining and keeping power, where do you see this country in 20 years? In, you know, how bad could things get? Thank you very much.
I prefer not to think in negatives. I prefer to be more optimistic. I think their gig is up, personally. I think there's something that works beyond left and right and Democrat, Republican in this country, and there's a certain consistency that's been maintained in the midst of turbulent times within inner Washington circles. These are career diplomats, career intelligence officers, career behind-the-scenes workers in government. I think a great deal of these people are very concerned right now about this administration, about the manipulation of truth, about using their particular organizations for their own benefit and making their own organizations look bad. I think there's a reason why you have 1 week the administration accusing Newsweek of inventing a story when in fact they were reporting on a story. And then this wild assumption that there's actually people in Afghanistan lining up for their weekly copy of Newsweek, and it's somehow affecting public opinion over there. But the fact that that happened 1 week, the administration was intimidating Newsweek into a retraction. And then within 1 week, there is a leak from the FBI that results in front-page story on the New York Times saying, there was, in fact, Koran abuse in Guantanamo.
Yeah, I wonder if that's going to lead Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh to retract their criticism of Newsweek.
Well, probably not. But the point I'm getting at is that I think there are people in high-ranking offices in these intelligence agencies that want to see Bush fall and this administration fall.
Yeah, we had Seymour Hersh on the air a few weeks ago, and his whole source base are those people. And he made that point emphatically, that the higher-up people in the Pentagon and the State Department, the intelligence community, a significant percentage of them are troubled almost beyond words by what's going on in this country right now.
Because they see the reality, and they see they see probably far worse of a nightmare than you or I could possibly imagine. And so those are going to be our patriots in the coming months and years. These are going to be the people that will determine whether the republic survives or not.
We're talking to Tim Robbins today, Media Matters. Tim, we got another severe thunderstorm watch in this part of the country. This is something that happens quite a bit this time of year. For people living here in Champaign County or Coles County, Douglas, Edgar, and Vermilion counties here in Illinois, there is a severe thunderstorm watch until 7:41 p.m. tonight. So Champaign, Coles, Douglas, Edgar, and Vermilion counties, severe thunderstorm watch until 7:41 p.m. We have time. We have one more caller here. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Tim Robbins.
Hi. It's an honor to talk to such a good actor and activist. Howard Zinn on this program mentioned a possibility for a removal from office of a people's tribunal similar to the one that was called against war crimes in Vietnam. It's a good idea. How do you get any footing? How do you get any attention? He and Seymour Hersh both thought that there's just no way with this Republican control to get actual governmental official channel impeachment. Your comments, and thank you.
Yeah, and Tim, I should add one other thing before you answer that. We had Representative Bernie Sanders from Vermont on the air maybe 6 weeks ago, and this question came up. I think it was the first question a caller had for him. And his response was that he thinks that Bush clearly is impeachable by the record, but that politically it would be hopeless and that activists should put their energy into other stuff because it would be a futile run. And that was 6 weeks ago. Maybe his tune has changed with the Downing Street memo. I don't know.
Well, I'm just talking within the record there is enough. There's a bigger hurdle, really, is the media.
Yeah, I think that was what Bernie.
They're not even reporting the Downing Street memo. I think they have a lot at stake here as well. By the way, we should also impeach certain people in the media because they were so compliant and with the Bush administration's wishes before the war. They had the evidence that the weapons of mass destruction didn't exist. They were running uncorroborated stories in the front pages of their papers regarding these weapons. So they're compliant too. People's Tribunal would be an exercise what would it do effectively? I think the first step for all of us is to spread more information, to make sure that information gets out there, and to organize locally, politically, so that when the next election comes, people aren't knocking on someone's door for the first time. I think, it was a lot of volunteers in the last election, but these people, the volunteers that work once every 4 years and wonder why nothing changes. Well, the Republicans have people working year-round, every year, every month, and they're knocking on doors all the time, and they're in churches, in local churches organizing. And so when an election comes around and there's a knock on the door, these are people that these people know. They've known them for 4 years.
Tim Robbins, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you so much for taking an hour out of your day here to join us on WILL AM 580 here in Urbana, Illinois. Good luck with Embedded Live, which is available again at embeddedlive.com or on Netflix. The DVD of your play from Broadway or from New York and from Los Angeles. And again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and we'll be back 1 week from today. We've got 3 weeks of recorded shows for you. Greg Palast in a week and a lot of great people thereafter, and I'll be back at the end of the month. See you later.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, breezy with a high in the lower 90s and south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms during the evening, the low in the upper 60s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour and gusts up to 30 miles per hour during the evening. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, public radio for Central Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.